Okay, we'll call the meeting. Should you take the roll, please?
Chair Treachok?
Yes.
Vice Chair Carter? Regent Del Carlo?
I'm here.
Regent Hayes?
Here.
Regent Perkins?
Here.
You have a quorum present. Advisory member roll call. Mr. Campbell?
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll move to agenda item number one, public comment. Is there any public comment in Las Vegas?
No.
I take that as a no. Is there any public comment in Reno?
Yes, sir.
And please state your name.
Good morning, members of the Investment Committee and guests. My name is Dr. John Sageville. I had a 14-year career as an atmospheric chemist at the Desert Research Institute before joining UNR, where I've been for about the last 13 years. I live in a zero-net energy home, and I only own electric cars. I've taught classes in sustainability at UNR, and I am, among other things, chair of the university's sustainability committee. I'm speaking to you today for myself as a concerned citizen and a member of this community. Exactly 1 week ago, the largest climate protest ever took place across the world with over 4 million people participating. Climate change will continue to impact all of us, most notably future generations. It is for the future that I am addressing you today. The great writer of the American West, Terry Tempest Williams, once wrote, "The eyes of the future are looking back at us, and they are praying for us to see beyond our own time." The people who built these great universities here in Nevada clearly thought of this as they planned for and built for beyond their own time. The challenge of global climate change, both now and in the future, is fundamentally of eliminating our dependence on fossil fuels. Humans didn't end the Stone Age because we ran out of stones. The same will be true of the fossil fuel age. One approach taken by dozens of universities across this world, most recently the University of California system, is to divest their holdings from fossil fuel companies. I'm asking today that this committee take up this question and investigate the practicalities of such a divestment. Even an interim step, such as stopping further investment in fossil fuels, would be a great start. Some might argue this is a purely symbolic gesture, that money will flow from elsewhere to these companies and nothing will change. That's not necessarily true. Much of this oil that's in the ground will become what economists call stranded assets, worthless. It is also an educational moment we stand at today, a way to teach our students and our broader community about our commitment to helping solve this problem. Education is core to our mission, and I can think of no better way to both help that mission and our future. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any other public comment?
Yes.
Hello, Investment Committee. My name is Sierra Jickling. I'm representing myself as a student today at the University of Nevada. First, I really just wanted to thank you all for adding the environmental, socially responsible governance investing options to your agenda today. It really shows to the students that you did listen to us when we showed up at your meetings over the last couple years, and we appreciate being recognized in that way. And we're really interested to hear how the meeting will go today. I wanted to echo the words of Dr. Sageville and also just reaffirm that the students have been asking over the last 2, 3, 4 years for a move towards that divestment from all fossil fuel assets. That is very important for us moving forward in the future. I think that not just locally, but globally, we're seeing a huge push to that. Again, the UC schools did divest from fossil fuels, and they have a goal at the end of this month to remove all of that from all 10 of their campuses. I think that's an incredible step, and I am very excited at the possibility that the University of Nevada and all Nevada higher education might have the opportunity to join the University of California system in this moment of leadership. So thank you for your consideration, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other public comment? Seeing none, we'll move to agenda item number...
Elko?
What's that?
Yeah, Elko.
Do we have Elko?
Somebody from Elko?
No public comment from Elko.
Good job. We don't see you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, we'll go to agenda item number two. Do I have a motion for approval of the minutes from our last meeting?
So moved.
Second? Got to come from down
second.
There. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Okay, we'll move to agenda item number 2.5, Chair's report. And what I'd like to do is explain a couple of the items that we'll have, I'm hoping we'll have a robust discussion today on. We'll start with Andrew Klinger will give us an overview of the operating pool and the different funds within the operating pool, and also give us an overview of the our endowment pool. I would like the members of the committee to think about the following. If you take a look at our endowment pool, we have a total of $260 million, plus or minus. And this is endowment gifts from private donors to the universities and to the colleges and to the DRI, leading up to the legislation that formed the institution foundations back in the 1980s. And the question I would like us to ponder, and that I'll put on our next agenda, would be to move to the foundation.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I just have a point of order. We don't have a chair's report agendized, and talking about new business is appropriate in the new business section. If this is an introduction to item 3, can we move to item 3? But I think under the open meeting law, we can't add a chair's report that is discussing new business items at this point. Chief Counsel Reynolds can correct me if I'm wrong, but I just want to make sure we're doing everything according to the law.
According to our counsel, he said that I could give a chair's report even though it wasn't on the agenda. And I'm just throwing out what I am going to be bringing back to the committee in the future for everybody to think about, so that we can, it's not a surprise when you first get the agenda. This is something that we need to be thinking about as a committee. And then the third item is there will be a discussion, on, I think it's on agenda item number 6, from those business officers that are present concerning the income from the operating pool. And what I would encourage those business officers and our CFO, that we have a thorough discussion on how we handle the income, because I think it's incumbent upon us as members of this committee to hear all the arguments for what we've been doing up to this point in time, so we can make an informed decision. How do we both vote on item number 6, and how do we handle this in the future? And so what I'd like now is to have Andrew just to give an overview on the explanation of the responses to the questions that were sent to our two investment or OCIOs, and also just give an overview what money we have in these different funds, so that when we start talking about the operating pool and the endowment pool, everybody has a frame of reference.
Chair, you all right?
Yes.
Okay. This is Andrew Klinger, for the record, Chief Financial Officer. I think Chair Trachok did a good job of explaining the Inchi endowment, and so I don't, unless Chair Trachok wants more on that, I think that explanation is good. And what the chair asked me to do on the operating pool is just describe for the members and for the public sort of what that is. So in the operating pool, in the packet, you'll see that there's $850 million in the operating pool. And I think the easiest way to describe what the operating pool is it's essentially the collection of checkbooks, if you will, from the various institutions. And within those checkbooks, there are literally thousands of accounts throughout the system that feed into this operating pool. And all that cash that's sitting in those various accounts rolls up to the operating pool. So when you look at it, in this agenda, and you say, wow, $850 million, that's a lot of money. But when you spread it out amongst those thousands of accounts, and I can give you an example, at the last Regents meeting, I presented the excess fee report for capital fees and general improvement fees. Well, all those reserves that were presented in that report are part of the operating pool. So this is literally all of the operating funds. It does not include the foundation accounts, and it does not include the NCHI endowment funds. These are literally the operating funds or checkbooks for each of the institutions. And I think once we get into that item, per the chair's request, we can have a discussion on the way the earnings accrue in that account and the way they're distributed out to the campuses. The other thing that I'll point out, and they are in your packet, we sent a series of questions to both of our OCIOs. And you'll see for Russell Investments, it is an attachment at the end of item 3, includes their responses to those questions. And then for Cambridge, it is in their presentation under item 4. And maybe quickly just to go through for the committee the questions that were asked and the responses, and I'll let the OCIOs get into more detail, but just generally what the responses were. So the first question that we asked is, has there been any problems with the investment process that either of the OCIOs think can be fixed? And generally, the answer to that question was no. I mean, there's obviously more detail in their responses, and I'll let them get into that. Is the shortfall in investment returns within a reasonable tolerance? Again, generally, I think the answer is yes. I will point out Russell Investments made some comments about the hedge funds and how there's been some challenges there, and again, they can get into more detail on that. Question 3 was, is the shortfall investment returns in relation to the benchmarks greater than that experienced during the same or other periods of underperformance in comparison to similar clients? And the answer for both was generally that this is within a reasonable range compared to other clients. Number 4, given the shortfall in expected returns since inception, do you believe your firm can still deliver investment returns which meet or exceed the established benchmarks 3 to 5 years from inceptions? Russell Investments, I think, hedged a little, in my opinion, and just said, if there is a bear market that transpires in the next 12 to 24 months, the portfolio will likely lag its long-term strategic objectives. I think Cambridge and Associates, generally, the answer was, yes, we can continue to meet those expected returns. Question 5, can the investment process be improved to produce better outcomes? And the answer there was for Russell Investments that if the committee is seeking to reduce costs, the committee should consider eliminating the hedge funds and offset that with allocations to fixed income strategies. Cambridge and Associates generally talked about some of the fee concessions that they have received over the years. I think 433 fee concessions were cited in that process. So other than that, there were no suggestions to improve for better outcomes. Number 6, if the lower than expected investment returns compared to benchmarks are the result of misplaced benchmarks, what should the committee consider to better gauge? Russell Investments recommended changing the diversifiers allocation benchmark, and that's actually in item number 7 today. And then Cambridge recommended changing the public real estate assets benchmarks, which is also in item 7 today as well. Question 7 that was asked, how is our investment performance in comparison to similar clients? And generally the answer was that we are comparable to other clients. I will say Cambridge and Associates did cite that for endowments in the range of 100 to 300 million, which is obviously where we sit, that we were just below the median for returns. And then finally, question eight, are there any changes that we should make in our investment policy statements to allow more freedom in order to achieve higher returns? And for Russell Investments, no changes recommended other than the benchmarks that we talked about earlier. And then for Cambridge, I think the one change there was to allow them to purchase secondary private market investments and participate in co-investments were the two recommendations there. So, Mr. Chair, that's a summary of the responses to the questions, and certainly there's more detail in there that the committee may wish to ask the two OCIOs to elaborate on.
Okay, thank you very much. I just wanted to give the committee and, for the record, an overview of what funds this committee and the Board of Regents is responsible as the trustees, and number two, the questions that have been submitted a few months ago to our OCIOs, and just a summary of the responses. We'll have a more detail, the opportunity to discuss in more detail when we cover those items. We'll move now to agenda item number three, endowment pool performance, Russell Investments.
Good morning.
Morning.
So typically in the past we've talked about market performance as a context. I think let's just talk about the performance of the portfolio on this occasion, unless you want to talk about how stock market, equity, and bond markets have performed.
No, I think what would be really helpful is focus on two things. How did we do compared to our benchmarks, your comments on that, and then all in, including if you could use 2018 as calendar year, how much did it cost us?
Okay, very good. All right, well, I'll draw your attention. Let's start on page 28 in our presentation materials. I apologize if you've renumbered them in a consolidated packet, but it's a chart that has basically it's a table that has returns, total assets at the top, and then it has.
So Matt, can I interrupt you just real quick? So the replacement page that you turned over,
yep,
as a 30.
Okay. So do we want to concentrate on end of August or end of June?
End of August.
Okay. All right. Very good. The themes are very much the same. So starting on page 30, quarter to date for the last 2 months, the portfolio that we are running for you delivered about a negative 1.5% return. It is behind its benchmark by a little over 100 basis points. On a calendar year-to-day basis, so basically January 1st through end of August, the portfolio is up 8.4%, again, behind its benchmark by, let's call it, about 250 basis points. So on an absolute basis, for the year-to-date, the portfolio has, I think, behaved in keeping with what we'd hope. It's ahead of your goal, your CPI plus 4.7% goal. So on that basis, it's successful. On a relative basis, it certainly has not done the job as we would have hoped. So a little disappointing. As we look through the underlying components, there's really four blocks that we use. We have a growth component, which is largely speaking equities. There's the diversifier piece, which is the hedge funds, real assets, which is a private real estate portfolio, and then fixed income is a bond portfolio. If we take those each in turn, what you'll notice is the majority of the shortfall over the quarter as well as the calendar year to date are attributable to the growth assets as well as the hedge fund portfolio. The bond portfolio, the real assets have generally speaking done their job, which I'm pleased to see. The growth assets, they have the highest nominal return year to date, 9.9%. It's trailing its benchmark by over 3%. Why is that? So we have made some very conscious decisions within the growth portfolio, and specifically those are we have been adding more weight to value, so stocks that are generally at a discount to their long-term valuation. At this point in the market cycle, we believe that that is the right choice. We're now in the 11th year of a bull market. Equity market valuations are very high. We're preferring not to overweight those stocks that have had the best performance over the last 12, 24 months. And the reason being is that typically as you look at patterns of performance, when stocks have gone through an extraordinarily good run, it doesn't persist forever. They come to a point, they settle, and then oftentimes there's a retrenchment, kind of a fallback in that. We would rather not be keeping adding weight to the portfolio in that segment on the chance that it actually has a reversion in price. So we've been actually consciously buying stocks that have been trading at a cheaper discount. That has not been the right choice. so far in 2019, to be honest, because momentum and kind of tech-led stocks have continued to be the outperformers. So did we make the right choice fundamentally? Yes. In retrospect, we shouldn't have been leaning into value. We should have kept a full weight in growth stocks, and that has actually held our relative performance back. Kind of coincidentally with that, we have kind of isolated on a geographical basis that the U.S. stock market is the least attractive from a valuation perspective. And so we have been underweight United States stocks relative to the rest of the world. We've had more weight in Europe, Japan, a little bit in emerging markets. Again, those are conscious decisions. We're trying to look out over the next couple of years of where do we think there is, I'm going to call it more safety, the potential for better returns. And I look at fundamental indicators such as how is the earning growth in the United States playing out relative to the rest of the world. And if you look at projected earnings growth, the U.S. is actually kind of tepid. Let me see if I left this exhibit in the deck. I hope I did because I think it's very instrumental. Let's go to page 11, if you don't mind, and I can kind of highlight this for you a little bit of kind of the basis of our reasoning here. So on page 11, we show a series of metrics. Most of these are looking backward, but there's a couple that are forward-looking. And we've lined up the various broad geographies around the planet and said, okay, what looks good, what doesn't look so great. The top three indicators on the left-hand side of the page, trailing price to earnings, forward price to earnings, price to book ratio. What you'll notice is that the U.S., which is the blue triangle, is on the furthest right. So that means it is the most expensive on a trailing basis. It also, ironically, is the most expensive on a forward-looking basis. Sometimes that's not a bad thing. If you really are optimistic about economic growth in various countries, that might be okay. But on balance right now, at this point in the market cycle, we're not too keen on betting the house on the most expensive thing available. If you look down on the bottom half of that set of six items, you'll notice that projected earnings growth in the United States is 3.5%. That is well off where it has been over the last, I'm going to call it 5 years. Probably maybe less than half, maybe a third of what corporate earnings growth has been. And if you compare that to where the European earnings growth is projected to be or emerging markets projected earnings growth is to be, honestly, the U.S. looks less attractive. It's more expensive. It has less growth potential. Right now, earnings rate or interest rates stateside, ironically, is coming down, but we're still probably have the highest interest rates on the planet. What that means is that the corporations abroad have the ability to borrow more cheaply to fuel their economic growth, so to speak, produce better earnings. And so the U.S. corporations are maybe a little bit of a disadvantage. Lastly speaking, dividend yield oftentimes is part and parcel of the thinking on the retail side. As an individual investor, you want income, but it doesn't mean that it's ignored on the endowment or the institutional side. Right now, the U.S. dividends growth is not very, dividend yield is not very attractive. Again, it's a reinforcement that stocks are expensive and what you're getting for them is relatively modest. So if you look at all these in conjunction, you would probably agree with us that right now the U.S. isn't the market that we would want to put a full weight in. So we've been making that decision to be underweight the United States for the better part of 18 months now. Again, we've been early, I guess, is one way to say it. Maybe wrong would be another one over the short term. Long term, we think this is actually the right place to be. So we have suffered a lot of slings and arrows as a result of this. Our performance is a couple percent, 3% back because of these broad factor decisions. We've also had some weaker stock selection by our value managers. We've recently gone in and reevaluated them and said, do we still think they're good at what they do? And we have reaffirmed that view and we say they are. So within the growth component, absolute returns calendar year to date, not awful, well ahead of, I think, what the objective would be. Relative to where we could have been, yes, we've had some opportunity cost, if you will, and we've not done the job as well as we would have liked, but I think we've set ourselves up, hopefully, better for the next 12 to 24 months in producing benchmark ahead or benchmark relative returns that are positive rather than the results we've generated thus far. Okay, let me stop there for a moment. Mm-hmm. Questions on that?
Any questions?
Okay.
I do have a question.
Yes,
it's a recurring question, and it's in terms of our benchmark. Have we set our benchmark at the appropriate level?
I believe it is the correct benchmark. This is a collection of 75% is an equity benchmark, and then another 25% is comprised of things like real assets, infrastructure, real estate investment trusts, some commodities, as well as high-yield debt and emerging markets debt. In our philosophical view, as we look back through time, we see all of those asset classes as generating returns that are, largely speaking, on par with a long-term equity return expectation. And so for our perspective, we believe that it's, even though there's different pieces underlying the custom benchmark, they are all aligned with your long-term goal. We think it is the right benchmark. We don't think it's excessively difficult. We think it's properly configured for the objective, but neither is it too easy. This is, as you can see, it was up 13, almost 14% this year. It is producing the results that you want. Long-term, over the last, let's call it 2.5 years, that benchmark is up over 8%, so it is well ahead of your bogey. So I believe it is properly constructed for the objective, but not so easy as that we would have a great time beating it all the time. As you can see, we've struggled relative to that. Okay? Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I just wanted to know, so, I mean, we've been hearing it, and you discussed how, whether you're earlier or wrong, at what point do you reassess your opinion? I mean, is it 6 months from now? Are we still hearing you were early in making the decision to pull back on U.S. stocks? Is it a year from now? I mean, eventually everybody's going to be, what goes up must come down. If I say it's going to come down, eventually it's going to be right. But at some point, there's a lot of opportunity cost lost. Is there a reassessment point, and where is that?
I can assure you internally we are asking that question very vigorously of our investment teams. We all feel the pain. You are not alone in this particular performance. I have probably 50% of my book of clients that I work with have this exact investment vehicle. So we are beating on the doors of our investment team and saying, are you sure? Are you really convinced that this is the right bet to be making? And up to this point, they continue to say yes. Their view is that we are closer to a period of economic turmoil and market turmoil, specifically a recession and a bear market. And for their investment view, this is the right portfolio for that type of scenario. We've actually been of the opinion that a recession was in the works for the better part of, I would say, a year and a half now. And then around that time frame, we had the current administration put into place, a tax package, which was unusual, highly unusual. We typically don't see fiscal policy this late in an economic cycle. What that did is actually make us a little bit wronger, if you will, because it accelerated the economic growth cycle for longer than it typically would have been. Regent Hayes, I think your question is the right one. We are asking this internally. I keep talking to the PMs. Are you convinced? And they say yes. So I will update you in the spring, and I'm hopeful that our forecast will have started to become a little more right. The problem with it is if we are right, that means the absolute returns are probably going to suffer, and we may gain on the back on a relative basis, but that's kind of cold comfort. We're saving you pain, but there could be more pain in an absolute sense.
Yeah. If I could follow up, Mr. Chair. I understand. I mean, trying to guess a peak or a valley is a fool's game. And you're never going to exactly guess when right before a recession is going to happen or a growth period is going to begin. But compared to your peers across the country, have others made the similar wrong guess or early decision to pull back where you have? Or is this kind of something unique to Russell?
You know, I don't think we're alone in this view. I believe that collectively the investment community, you can see it in the financial press almost every day. You can hear CEOs talking about becoming more conservative in how they run their businesses. We've seen a raft of layoffs in advance of that, especially in the financial markets or financial industry. I don't think we're alone in this view. From an investment perspective, I suspect we've been more aggressive in taking down portfolio risk in advance of potential market correction. But I don't think we're alone. I think there's others that are of the same viewpoint and have been leaning into value and away from things that seem expensive, just like we have. But
I'm happy to confirm at Cambridge we have very similar viewpoints. We're tilted away from the U.S. modestly, just based on our view of valuation risks in the United States, valuation risks in growth stocks. We're leaning into the geographies and the styles that have recently underperformed because We think the stuff that's up here at the peak has higher risk of coming back down if there is a sell-off. It doesn't have a margin of safety from a valuation perspective.
Any other questions? I have one follow-on question. So you said this is what the managers are telling you and your group. For you personally, do you agree with the recommendations you're receiving from them?
I do. I mean, you may recall that my job was this, that function in the past. And I do believe that this is the right call. It's a little bit galling to have been on a relative basis wrong and been wrong for a while now. That's upsetting to me because I'd like to think that we can be as tactical as anyone and get ahead of it. But we've looked at these indicators and felt like it's better to be a little more dogmatic and taking our positions early and sticking with them. The thing that I am absolutely telling my investment staff is we cannot unwind this. In face of bad performance or bad relative performance, I don't want to see us blink. Unless there is a fundamental change in our viewpoint about what the market tomorrow is going to do. On that basis, I'm happy to revisit that, but I am in agreement with my investment staff that this is the right choice.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
All right, so let me take the other kind of couple components in place. The diversifier piece, this is the other kind of meaningful source of underperformance over the trailing year. Year to date, it hasn't been as bad. It's delivered around two.
What page are you on?
Still on page 30. I'm now on the diversifiers segment of that bottom half of the table. For the quarter, that portfolio delivered about 0.9%, a little ahead of its bogey, the current bogey. For the year to date, it's up about 2.6%, but we are behind that particular absolute return benchmark of LIBOR plus 4. Longer term, you see over the 1 year, that has been a very, very ugly outcome. We're back over 6%, almost 7%. The reason being, it comes down to a couple of key components in the portfolio. We have a credit manager, a distressed credit hedge fund manager, and they have been very aggressive in buying into debt in South America, primarily Brazil and Argentina. And I don't know how much you read about the financial goings-on in that part of the world, but Argentina has now effectively defaulted again on its national debt on a technical basis. It has been a country that has gone through a lot of turmoil over the last three or four decades. And about 10 years ago, they came out of their last kind of economic oopsie, and they reformed their government. They put into place a lot of folks that were very encouraging to Western investors. And over the last 10 years, they seem to have been very well behaved. This manager is of the opinion that the corporations in Argentina and Brazil have the opportunity to issue debt, accrue really high yields on that debt as an investor, and it was a very attractive portfolio. I'm sorry, is there a question?
You were still referring to page 30.
Page 30.
But you said a minus 6%? Or
I'm looking at the relative difference between the negative 1.37 and the 5.9. Apologies for that. So we've had an exposure to some Argentinian credit. It's been very distressed. That has not worked out very well for us. So that has been a very painful experience. We've also had a long-short manager that was not sufficiently directional. What I mean by that is it didn't have hardly any equity exposure on a long basis. And it had some stock selection on the short side of its book that was very painfully felt, particularly among the industrial and consumer staples area. So we've had a couple of portfolios that have gone a little bit awry from us. Not everything is underperformed in that hedge fund portfolio, but we've had two big pieces that have driven the majority of that shortfall. Again, I've gone to that investment team. Our portfolio manager said, is this working as you intended? And they have actually gone in the last 2 months and done research meetings with the two portfolio and sub-advisors that have had these shortfalls. And they've said, yes, they still think that they are good caliber managers. The decisions they made, they felt, were fundamentally based in a good way. They are being patient, and they're expecting those to work their way out. I think a question that was asked last time was, how long is it going to take to recover this kind of shortfall? And I asked that question of our portfolio management team, and in their opinion, it is probably 2 or 3 years before we see this shortfall kind of recouped. And that is longer than I would like to see, but I think it is an honest answer that this isn't something that we're going to fix overnight. We're going to do our best. We've seen better results in the last couple of months, but that needs to continue. for quite a while now for us to kind of see a better outcome long term.
Your recommendation is to hold the course.
I am, and I apologize if there was some prevarication that was interpreted from my comments in the written response. We believe hedge funds remain a valuable part of your aggregate portfolio. The experience you've encountered is on the outer end of our expectations. I did some math for you in the response. It is probably a 1 in 10 year event. I did the math. It's within expectations, broadly speaking, but I don't like what has happened. Again, that's where I had to go back to my team and say, do you believe this is extraordinary, or is this kind of acceptable? And they said, it's on the outer end of acceptable. I think that hedge funds still have a long-term place in the portfolio as a diversifier and as a source of return. They complement your equity portfolio, particularly as we come into a period where we may have more distress in just naked equities. I want hedge funds in there. So you may have saw there was a response about, well, you could save some money by taking out your hedge fund allocation. That was specifically into one of the sub-questions. Like, I got the impression that you wanted to save money or you wanted to lower your fees. And I said, well, if that was the case, this would be the lowest hanging fruit to do that with. But strategically speaking, I believe it's still very much a valuable part of your portfolio. Okay.
I have sort of an overall question. It's not surprising that you underperform sometimes, outperform sometimes. Both OCIOs were hired to actively manage this portfolio, to take bets that are different from just investing passively in the market. My question to you is, on an overall sense, is do you set guardrails internally to say, you know, if we underperform by 5%, we're going to cut back the risk that we've got in the portfolio because it's just gone too far, it's going to take forever to recover this? Do you have internal guidelines for risk management?
We do.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think we specify it in the way that you're describing, like there's a go to cash kind of behavior. Like if you go a certain threshold, you know, you stop investing, so to speak. That typically has not been probably great kind of portfolio management behavior. But to your question, we do have internal risk metrics, risk guidelines. We monitor these every day. And of course, it's a look ahead. We say, all right, given the context of securities we know we hold in our portfolio, how do we think those are likely to behave, either positively or negatively over the next 6 or 12 months? And our portfolio management team, using the data they have, said these were acceptable decisions. The way that they played out, and as you look at it after the experience has occurred, you say, well, okay, let me go back and I can do the kind of the evaluation, the attribution of that occurrence, but I don't stop investing. I keep investing, and I look again at the portfolio today, at that new period, and I say, is it more risky than I thought it was? And if it's not, that is typically a validation to say, yes, I'm going to continue to invest on this basis, even though I have encountered negative performance on a relative basis.
Okay. Do you also want to mention, since you're talking about risk management, you mentioned that you have risk management tools that may be available to Andrew, I guess?
We can show you output from that. It's not something we can give you live access to, but I can certainly show you. One of our primary tools is risk metrics. We use FactSet platforms or Bloomberg platforms to kind of decompose the risk drivers at each of the elements of the portfolio and say on a go-forward basis how much of the tracking error or the relative extra risk we're taking in the portfolio, what do we expect to come from each of those three pieces. And I can certainly send that to you if that would be of use. Okay. I'm sure I don't forget about that. I'll take a quick note.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
No, I just want to make sure we have all questions answered at this stage in the presentation. Next.
Do you want me to talk? I'll talk a little bit about real assets and then the fixed income pieces, and that'll seal off this part of the discussion.
Okay.
The real assets in our portfolio, it's a little different than how the folks at Cambridge do it. This is exclusively a private core real estate portfolio. It's meant to be a very kind of durable, steady eddy. Long-term, we expect real estate, and these are commercial buildings that you might see in downtown Vegas or Reno or Seattle, that have long-lived leases, high occupancies. We typically are buying, we want to be in kind of the tier one cities, the big cities that have more durable economic bases, so you don't end up with high variations in your occupancy. And so you end up with kind of return streams that are very durable. Typically, we expect private real estate to generate around 6-7%. The majority of that would oftentimes come from the income component, the rents, the leases that are paid on the buildings. Over the last, I would say, 5+ years, maybe longer than that, the commercial sector has done very, very well. building prices have gone up quite a bit, and the capital gains that were attributable to that reflect very positively on this space. Recently, we've seen kind of a slowdown in that capital appreciation of these buildings, and so on a go-forward basis, we're expecting this to generate probably 4 to 5% in the portfolio. Year to date, we're generating around 2.1. That's a little below where I'd like to see it. Most of that is income. And our portfolio team is actually looking through what changes they want to make to the managers they hold in that portfolio. Over the trailing year, we're up about 5.6, again, against a benchmark of about 6.7. So we have a little work to do there, but it has been a solid performer on a one-year basis. And again, if the point of having real assets in your portfolio is to provide diversification, it has done just that. Again, to the point I made earlier on the hedge funds, I like core real estate. I think it is a very nice part of the portfolio and provides ballast when things get a little bit more shaky. The last component of the portfolio is fixed income. This is oftentimes that real ultimate risk anchor when things go bad. We've seen some unusual behavior in interest rates or yields over the course of 2019. We've seen, for example, the 10-year rate fall by over 1.25%. That's a very unusual move. Most of that was driven by the market. The Federal Reserve did have some impact on that, but a lot of that was kind of a move to risk-off behavior in the last couple of months. So we've seen bond returns jump quite a bit. Over the last 2 months, they're up over 2% in line with the benchmark. Over the calendar year-to-date, they're up over 8%. That is a fabulous return for bonds on a 8-month basis. Typically, bonds deliver, 3 to 4%. That's a great year. And so to be that much ahead of it on a year-to-date basis is quite remarkable. So this part of the portfolio I've had no concerns with. We've actually become a little bit more quality-oriented in it. We are adding more to our government exposure and taking away from corporate credit. Typically, corporate credit pays a higher yield. But at this point in the cycle, corporations are very highly levered. We don't want to be taking on additional default risk. So we've been buying more securitized debt as well as bond, government bonds to provide that surety factor, particularly if we come into a period of a rollover in the credit cycle. So that part of the portfolio is behaving as intended. So in summation, relative returns have not been as ideal as we'd like to have them be, honestly. I am disappointed by that, and I apologize for that. I would like to see us do better. On an absolute basis, I think we've done okay, particularly in 2019. Over the trailing 1 year, that number you'll see is 74 basis points. The reason for that is, if you recall, fourth quarter of 2018 was very painful, particularly the months of October, November, and December, and where we had a very massive drop in equity prices during that period. So that number reflects that particular episode. Since inception, up about 5.7% net of fees. That's a little below your long-term objective, but like I said, there are some variation in annual performance. We are still suggesting a 5-plus year horizon is the appropriate window to judge our performance by, and I'm, knock on wood, trusting that we're going to be ahead of that bogey for you over that window. Okay?
I have one more question. Do you have investments in private equity and private companies?
We do not yet.
Oh.
And the reason being is because the legacy portfolio is still kind of in liquidation.
Okay.
We have chosen to not dip our toe in that until we have a more meaningful allocation allocated to us in that space, if that makes sense. We want to make it economic. We have just launched a commingled private markets vehicle that I will be using for Enshi, but we just don't have enough assets probably to put our toe in the water quite yet. Okay.
I have then one follow-on question on the fees.
Yes.
If I take a look at the 3B, the last page in 3B, and then we're taking a snapshot of the calendar year 2018, and the fund that you were managing or overseeing was $101 million. And where the total fees paid to both Russell but also to the fund managers, am I reading this correctly, that's $970,000?
That is correct.
So we pay a little less in 2018, a little less than 1% for and that's all in.
That's all in. It includes our fee, the sub-advisory fee, and if there are any performance or incentive fees that are generated by the hedge fund managers, they would have been paid in this piece as well.
Perfect. Any questions? Thank you very much. That was very helpful. Agenda item number 4. Wendy.
Good morning.
Great, thank you. So I'll suggest that we start on page 11 of 67, or page 6 in the lower right in Cambridge's numbering. I'll start here. Given that Cambridge has a growing allocation to private investments and that this snapshot also includes legacy assets, which is almost 100% private investments, I'll start on this page, which ends this performance analysis as of March 31st, because that's the last date for which we have complete performance results. Private equity, venture capital, they report on a lag. June 30th results are still coming in. We have maybe 50% of them. So for right now, the Enshi Endowment, under our OCIO track record, has officially two full years of full formal track record. And this graphic here on page 11 of 67 sort of shows not only the performance, but also the volatility of performance. And I'll start with the fact... I'll start with total endowment, which is in orange in the left corner.
Actually, it's blue for us on the... if you're using online, then it's blue.
Oh, really?
If it's hard copy, it's orange.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Total endowment, then. Interesting. total endowment is in this upper left quadrant. This is exactly where we want our performance to be, is upper left. It means higher return than the benchmark and lower volatility to the left.
Okay, mine doesn't show on the upper left. It shows on the... lower
I'm talking right now about total endowment. Okay. I'm starting with the total endowment, which is orange, or maybe hopefully is orange.
Right at the top. This way.
Okay. I was looking for it in the quadrants.
Okay. You're referring to the table, right? Or
I'm referring to the quadrants.
Okay.
Okay, page 11. Okay. It is orange.
Okay.
Page 11.
Okay.
All right. So since we do consolidated reporting that includes Cambridge, Russell, and Legacy, I'll start with the total endowment. And the good news is relative to our benchmark, which is in the crosshairs here, that's the total endowment benchmark, the total endowment, the policy benchmark, the total endowment here is near the bottom of the upper left quadrant.
Okay.
Right? So we've had lower volatility and slightly higher returns. We like this low upper left quadrant. This is where we all hope to be over time. Peers, the Cambridge endowments in the same range. We have 120 clients who are endowments that have this similar asset size of 100 to 300 million. Happily, the total endowment is also higher return and lower volatility than this peer group. Kind of the star performer of the portfolio is our legacy assets, which is way up in the upper left. I had a client tell me once, we want to be up there in Seattle and not in the lower right, which is Miami. So I don't know if we agree with that, but for this purpose, we do. So legacy assets have been hugely, hugely beneficial to this portfolio. These are, you know, the long-term private investment vehicles. They've been just really delivering outperformance. And then their benchmark is down near Miami on the lower right. And this is comprised of public equity and public natural resources that mimic the proportions in this legacy asset. So if we had been in public assets instead of these private assets, we would have performed much weaker for the legacy benchmark. So then looking at CA managed assets, our benchmark, we are in this lower left quadrant, so we have delivered slightly lower performance, but also lower volatility than our benchmark. And what that implies, if we go over to this table on the right, is that on a risk-adjusted basis, and that's this measure called the Sharpe ratio, which is often used as a sort of normalized metrics of risk-adjusted returns, we're just behind the normalized benchmark. So, you know, I'd call these 0.03 difference as relatively indistinguishable. And I'll also point out here that all of this underperformance, that 50 basis points of underperformance, came in the first year and change of our track record. As EJ will talk about in a moment, over the most recent fiscal year, Cambridge has actually outperformed our benchmark. Any questions on this page? Does that make sense? Yes.
Go ahead.
The legacy assets, can you separate out the performance contribution of oil and gas versus investments in other private companies? Just rough. I know you can't do it off the top of
your head. So we have that on a different page.
Was it more than 7% from oil and gas? Or more than 14%?
Let me get us to a different page where we actually have the returns.
This is interesting because oil and gas stocks haven't been doing well in recent
years. Right, right. But these private assets, yeah. Let's see. On page 36 of 67, we have the legacy assets in. We don't have this same two-year period, but what you can see is, say, over the trailing one-year period as of March 31st, the legacy private equity was up 3.5%. Do we see this on page 36 of 67? It says the top left corner says legacy PI returned 16.5%.
Oh, yeah, 16.5. And there's a green box around it.
Yeah, so that's at the bottom, 16.5. But if you track it upwards, our legacy venture capital returned 36% over that one-year period.
So the oil and gas has underperformed.
Oil and gas is 8.4. And actually, private equity has also underperformed. That's 3.5%.
Okay.
So it's really been driven by the venture capital.
Right.
That said, when you look longer term, the private natural resources, say over the last 3 years, it's been 17.7%, right?
And then since we're on private equity, I'll ask this question. I was going to ask you, but you're not in it. There's been a lot of talk about private equity in recent months. First of all, everybody seems to still adore investments in private companies. The result is we've had a ton of cash come into this sector awaiting a home. There's not enough private equity companies to actually invest in. And the effect is, because of the weight of all this cash that's trying to be invested in private companies, it's driven down the value of companies. We've seen this now with WeWork, where it was, they tried to price it at $50 billion and then they cut it in half and cut it in half again, and there's still no demand for it.
Right.
So is that sort of a tipping point that indicates that maybe private companies don't deserve to get all this cash, and therefore the future returns from private equity won't be as stellar as they've been historically?
Yeah, I think we observe the same market dynamics, and we are very wary and very, very precise about our manager selection. And I would argue that this is Cambridge's bread and butter of where we add value in client portfolios. So for your point about the amount of we call it dry powder that's waiting to be deployed, this is particularly acute in the private oil and gas space. Our manager research team in that area is basically just backing off that space altogether. Even managers that we have over the long term thought were top tier, we're not committing to this next round of funds because there's too much dry powder out in the market, and we just don't think, looking ahead, the returns prospects look that good. On the buyout side, so these mega funds, we are steering clear of those because, again, we think that they're not offering differentiated returns.
This is largely SoftBank.
Yes, yes, yes. We have a bias towards smaller niche managers with what we see as a sort of a defensible moat around their strategy. They are operating in a space that we don't think any private equity or venture capital funds can get into. They're actually, and part of why we like private investment so much is that these teams have the opportunity to go in and actually add value operationally to these companies. It's not like the public markets where you're arguably just timing your buy decision and your sell decision properly, and whatever the return is, the return is. These teams actually have operational expertise to go in and help their portfolio companies develop their revenue, develop their profits, develop their customer base. And so it's these sorts of strategies where managers have the teams and the expertise to deliver on these returns and actually help the companies push their fundamentals ahead. That's why we gravitate there. And I'll also point out for calendar year 2018, Matt had mentioned, you know, markets were really down in the fourth quarter, and the total endowment was down for calendar year 2018 just because markets performed so poorly. The private investments, the legacy assets, was up over 12% for that calendar year. And it's just because these private companies aren't subject to the same market volatility, the same investor sentiment, right? They're still being valued more on what are the prospects of this particular portfolio of companies that this manager has.
Bottom line, they still like private companies.
We do. We do. But we completely agree with your assessment of the marketplace more broadly, and that's why we're trying to be really laser focused on segments where we think managers are poised to outperform.
Good. Okay. Great. So back to page six.
Great. I don't have any other comments about page six, but if anybody has questions, I'm happy to address them.
Any questions? Russell?
No.
Okay.
All right. So then turning to page seven, this is our calendar year-to-date performance. And again, I will caveat that this is still preliminary because we only have 3 months of private investments results included here. So once we get full private investment results for the June quarter and the September quarter, these numbers will go up for both legacy assets and Cambridge Associates. It does include 8 months of marketable results, that marketable manager results. I'll also point out September has seen a strong rebound in the markets. We estimate that the portfolio is up over 1% through yesterday for this month, so that sort of reverses the downturn in August. And that would put the total endowment at about 10% calendar year to date for the total endowment and about 12% calendar year to date for Cambridge. Again, preliminary, once we get those private investment results, those numbers would go upward. I'll start again with legacy assets at the bottom, but the comparative result for the calendar year to date looks weak. Again, I would suggest, because it's preliminary, because we have so few months of return here, I would suggest that this relative performance here, that negative 7.2%, is not meaningful, but rather if we look back to the beginning of our OCIO track record, this 12% versus 5% to the or 4.9% for the benchmark, this, you know, this is the sort of outperformance that we're targeting and that we hope to continue to deliver. I'll turn it over to EJ to talk a little bit about Cambridge, the Cambridge sleeve.
Wendy, thank you. And so I would just point your eyes to the left column of the green box there, calendar year-to-date performance. Of note, up almost 11% for that period is incredibly strong and should be noteworthy. We did lag the benchmark by 30 basis points there, but that is particularly due to our defensive posture. We have the investments in diversifiers, the hedge funds, fixed income and cash. That really, from an asset allocation standpoint, did couch the performance for that period. And so that's where the underperformance really came from. We actually had the outperformance was coming from our manager selection and our manager construction. Our structure within the asset subclass. Really, I would also just point out that this is really expected from an index standpoint. You know, performance, our asset allocation again was slightly underweight in equities or growth assets, but again overweight in these defensive asset classes, and really that was responsible for that 30 bips of underperformance there for that period. If there are no more questions here, I'll jump to the fiscal year end on the next page, page 13.
Page 13?
Or 13 page of 67, 13 of 67. Or 8 on the right, lower right corner, depending on which one you're looking at.
So this is fiscal year end 6/30, and so really what's driving performance here, if you just focus again on the timeline, this is not including about 3 months of performance from the private investment. So, again, that is you're seeing weaker performance than what we actually believe transpired over that time period. But I would divert your eyes to the bottom of the page where you have the total endowments performance of 4.8, as Andrew mentioned earlier. That, again, is really due to the choppy performance that we saw in Q4. Q4 of 2018 was really we saw a lot of volatility in the markets, and that was it created incredibly choppy markets for the entire portfolio. But we were protected on the downside, and you see that sort of in the far right column, the performance relative to the benchmark. You see the total endowment had 20 basis points of outperformance, and that's really, really calls out our how we protected on the downside there. And so if you sort of track up, you see the legacy assets outperformed during that period, as Wendy mentioned, and that's as expected, and that really contributed to performance. But I would also just focus again on the defensive posture that for our fixed income and our cash positions at that time. We were defensive by choice, and really from a fixed income standpoint, we really focused on the shorter duration assets, which provided more protection, more downside protection during that period. And you saw that again in the outperformance relative to the benchmark. But in up markets and positive performance that we've seen since Q4 in particular, we've sort of missed some of the upside there. But as Wendy alluded to earlier, from a risk reward standpoint, we're okay with that. That put us in a better position that we think for market cycles. And so I think that's worthy of note.
I have a quick question on the legacy assets.
Yes.
My understanding on the legacy assets, we don't make any interim decisions.
Correct. They're just rolling off.
We're there.
We hold them. They report to us. We're waiting for them to wind down. It'll take quite a number of years.
Well, there's still money to be called.
That's right.
We still owe $25 million. We've committed to $25 million to invest in those.
Is that true?
I hate to do this, but this third column is really, really complicated.
Okay.
Because if this is weighted performance of the portfolio relative to weighted performance of the benchmark, right?
No, it's absolute. Only the middle column is weighted.
So when it says performance, for example, the U.S. equity by asset class is 11.8. You're saying you outperformed the U.S. equity in the benchmark by 2.5%?
Correct.
Not weighted by
no.
the proportion of U.S. equity
no.
in the benchmark?
No.
Okay.
It's absolute. And we can note that. That's a good clarification.
Yeah. Because otherwise this is a really, really complicated
yes. No.
This is a three-dimensional check.
No. This is purely absolute.
Okay.
This is purely to just give a visual of what is contributing and what is detracting.
So bottom line is you're doing better in U.S. equities than the S&P 500.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Particular are strong. Yeah. I'll let
yeah,
you.
And I was just pointing out that we were doing essentially worse than the fixed income that outperformed during that period. As Matt alluded to earlier, almost 8%,
right.
or really 7% during this period here of outperformance really from fixed income. And so I also just wanted to point out that in terms of attribution, where this performance is really coming from, about half of the performance really came from our asset allocation, from our positioning,
okay.
and that is
okay.
a testament to our sort of defensive posture as the markets were choppy in Q4 of 18.
Okay.
But about half of the performance or the attribution came from our manager selection as well.
So actually what you could do then is you could say column one and column two together, like that one is the asset class weighting, the other is within each asset class how we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a good way to frame it.
I will note that for.
And then when we went back and when we looked quarter by quarter, our strong, so we just eked out just ahead of the benchmark, 10
right.
basis points ahead of the Cambridge managed assets benchmark
right.
for the full period. But our strongest performance was in Q4 when markets really tanked. And I've mentioned this before, but really for most of our clients, it's not just the absolute returns over the long term, but the path of returns, because when markets go down and you still need to make a spending distribution, it can be very painful. You know, you're locking in losses when you need to take money out when the portfolio is way down. So most endowments and foundations like a slightly less volatile performance pattern where you might not capture everything in a very, very strong bull market period, but you're protecting on the downside. And that smoothness, ends up compounding over the long term to benefit the institution.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
Why are we going to roll out the legacy assets if they're performing so well, or is that what we gave you with guidance back in 2016?
So it's basically, it's a point in time change, and basically Vic Redding got a real sweetheart deal here by negotiating that we split out the legacy assets and NSHE pays no OCIO fee for those. Cambridge, within our pool, we're continuing to make commitments to these sorts of of the same types of assets now in our pool, but the only reason it's split out here is because there's sort of a wall between the date, as of the date that the OCIO mandate started. Okay. So you're paying us for the new commitments that we're making now. The old commitments that were made under the, you know, before the OCIO regime are just split out as a different segment of the portfolio, and you're not paying any OCIO fee on that.
Okay.
It's only for reporting purposes that they're split out like this.
Okay, and then follow up. Just, you said it's going to take a lot of years. What is a lot of years? 5 years? 10 years?
I would say, let me...
From my personal experience, you could be looking at 10 to 20.
Yeah, okay. Well...
Because there's still $25 million to go into these funds. It's going to be a long time.
So if we look on page 28... it's $25 million, including the managed assets, which we're building up. But for the legacy assets, it's only $10 million in unfunded commitments. So this is on page 28.
Okay. 28
of 67.
Or 33 of 67. Yeah. Okay. So 28 on the lower right side, 33 of 67 in the middle.
But you typically, when you put a dollar into private equity, the time horizon is typically 10 years.
Correct.
And... trust me, you never get your money back in 10 years.
No, I absolutely agree. But the most recent commitment we made was in 2015.
Right.
So we're already a few years away from what our most recent commitment is. That was also a secondaries fund, which tends to return capital more quickly.
Right.
It was 2014 when we made commitments to a venture capital and a natural resources fund. And those... I would not be surprised, 12 years, so you're talking, 2026. The vast majority of the dollars, though, will be back, I would estimate, between 8-9 years. You know, you're going to have a long tail. But again, you're not paying any OCIO fee on that. You're just, they're winding down and you're collecting the benefits.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So. Any other questions?
Nope. Yeah, no, so I would close there to just point out that... really, the outperformance was due just the protection on the downside for that period of the fiscal year and 6/30.
And same question that I had with Russell. All in, what fees did we pay on the total amount that is being managed?
Yes, we put that in the executive summary, and that was just under $1.5 million. It's on page 3 on the lower right, or page 8 of 67 on the center.
Is that including legacy?
No. So this is just for CA managed assets.
Yeah. I think you reported the legacy fees as well.
Yeah. On the legacy, it was about
$500,000.
Yeah. I think it's worth maybe making a quick mention is that I've done a pro forma calculation of what our fees will likely look like if we were to have a full commitment to private equity.
Right.
It would probably be closer to $1.1 million. Using our current kind of math. So you saw the number of 970 from us earlier. We would be north of that, but because we haven't got to that place, that's why you see Cambridge with a bigger number, because it's a more expensive asset class.
And that's why on a the legacy assets have much higher fees, because private equity just is a higher fee structure vehicle. That said, it has been delivering significant outperformance to you net of those fees.
Right.
We're comfortable with paying, think of it as a commission that we're paying these managers to deliver very, very strong excess returns.
Bad news is if you're not comfortable with it, tough. You signed a contract.
This is true. You have the option of not investing if you don't like the fee structure.
Yeah.
And that actually, it's actually a good segue to one of our proposals. It's not in the policy IPS updates that we've recommended today, because I think it warrants more discussion with the NSHE finance team. But co-investments is something that we'd like to talk to you folks about potentially adding to the mandate, precisely because it allows for This is a way that private equity managers have come up with to effectively lower their fees. They allow their investors to come in to certain company-level deals on a no-fee, no-carry basis. And we can talk more about it later, but it's a kind of backdoor way that private equity managers are allowing investors to lower their all-in fees without reducing the headline fee, which they don't want to do.
No.
So we can talk about that some more, and there are some operational complexities that we really want to make sure are appropriate for this institution before we would move forward with that.
Okay. Any questions?
Could I make one
yes,
more?
Yes, absolutely.
I'd suggest on page 11 that we just also remember to think about, well, no, let me start on page 10, which is the time periods that we memorialized in the investment policy statement. And we do this for all of our clients because, again, we are always looking at performance and we're always monitoring performance. And it's important to understand where we're, you know, where, you know, Cambridge and Russell, like we've had the same headwinds from our underweight to the U.S. and our overweight to value. These have been painful points. And we want to understand where this outperformance and underperformance drivers are coming from. But when it comes to evaluating performance, we think it's really important to remember this is a perpetual pool, and we have a long-term investment strategy. And to have an active strategy, I think Russell phrased it very well earlier, if you're making active bets away from the market, they will never be every quarter or every year ahead of the market. That's just not going to be possible. So we really think it's important to continue to think about performance on a long-term basis. And when we do that, and when we look retroactively, and this goes back earlier into Cambridge's advisory relationship, we're happy with results. Again, we've delivered not quite the same absolute performance, but on a risk-adjusted basis in this lower right corner. Page 11 or 16 of 67. On a risk-adjusted basis, we have outperformed, and as I mentioned earlier, we're, you know, as part of this OCIO mandate, I think we have the flexibility to try to move up into this upper left quadrant is our goal, trying to get to Seattle. So I'll stop there.
Any questions? Okay, before we move to agenda item number 5, let's take a 5-minute break. Governance investing. Wendy.
Sure. So I'll start before even talking to these pages. One of the requests at the last meeting had been to share conference invitations. So we had sent out invitations to the committee to Cambridge's Impact Investing Forum, which took place in Baltimore 2 weeks ago, which had a lot around environmental resilience as one of the themes alongside social resilience and portfolio resilience. And I'll soon send an invitation. The next big conference that I think could be really interesting for anybody, any of the fiduciaries interested in this topic, in Tempe, Arizona, Intentional Endowments Network is hosting their Higher Education Leadership Summit. And in past years, there have been campus representatives from the various NSHE campuses going to this event. And it's sort of a mix of folks on the business operations side as well as the endowment and finance side. It's really looking at the intersection of all these topics. And I think most institutions, including University of California, really do think about these topics on a very integrated approach. So what are the campus priorities, what the campuses have established as their mission or as their strategic priorities, their investments from the operating budget, as well as then how can they deploy their endowment to push these topics forward. So that's an aside. Page 45 just gives an overview of you know, where we see opportunities. And
45 of the same.
So 50, yeah, of, 50,
50 of 67. 67. Right.
Yeah, the same.
And, you know, maybe I'll just, rather than going with the overview, maybe I'll just look at each part of the portfolio. So maybe start on page 46.
Maybe a better thing to do. Why don't you just give us in lay terms,
yeah,
a summary, what it is you think we should be doing, and then we can start drilling down and taking a look at it specifically.
Okay, sure. Great. So page 45, which is 50 of 67. So in the endowment, in CA, and I know Matt Beardsley also has a segment of his report that talks about how they approach these issues within the Russell portfolio. But I guess I'll start within CA Managed Assets, we have Cambridge has a responsible investment policy. We evaluate every manager's ESG approach as part of our getting comfortable with putting our clients' money in a manager.
Could you explain what ESG is?
Sure. Thank you. Environmental, social, and governance factors. It's a burgeoning approach within the investment management industry to really incorporating these topics like environmental sustainability or social equity, and really making sure that that a lot of these factors drive long-term financial performance for companies, and really trying to make sure that the investment management industry is considering these long-term factors as part of their investment approach.
This is a beyond fossil fuels, though, which has been the
exactly.
focus of our discussions.
Yeah. Although when we got the request from Andrew, it was related to yes, fossil fuels is one tranche of that.
Yeah.
And this is ESG more broadly. So We survey all of our managers on their approaches to ESG. We know that 43% of the managers in CA Managed Assets have an ESG policy. Like, they consider a company's social practices and environmental practices when they're making decisions. We have a whole host of other metrics, whether they're a signatory to the United Nations Principles for Responsible Investment, whether they consider climate change risk as part of their strategy. We have all these different survey answers from them. And what we've seen a lot of institutions do is if any of these particular issues are of particular interest to ENSHI, we can push more of ENSHI's managers as an investor. We can do either a private or a public, many institutions do it in a public fashion, letter campaign to their managers. Yale, David Swenson, the CIO, did this 3 or 4 years ago, where he issued a public letter to all of their investment managers saying, you as fiduciaries for Yale University, we are requesting that you incorporate climate change risks into your analysis of your portfolio companies, and we expect you to report back to us on your initiatives in that regard. So we can use ENSHI's influence as an investor to try to push more of the investment management industry into these practices.
Under this agenda item, would we have the ability to direct that action to be taken?
Joe Reynolds, for the record, yes. Chair Trachok. I mean, it's agendized as the committee may take action based upon potential pilot projects. It's agendized as a possible action item.
And how has that worked for instance, with Yale? I realize their endowment's a little bit larger than ours.
Yeah. It has helped to promote the dialogue. It's hard to say if any. More and more managers are incorporating ESG analysis into their processes anyway. Right now it's 43% of your managers. It's still probably a minority across the board, and it's hard to say whether any manager changed their approach just because of Yale's letter, but it's part of the ongoing trend, and I think it's very reasonable for institutional asset owners to ask their managers to adopt these sorts of practices, right?
Is that something that you would recommend this committee and this board doing?
Absolutely. I think it's very fair, and we've done it for other clients on a variety of topics that are important to the institution.
Can't hurt.
In particular, I think on page 46, we lay out the key metrics where we ask each manager what their approach is, and of these six that we survey, I think the second one down, having an ESG, a responsible investment policy, is eminently reasonable to ask any investment manager these days to put one in place if they don't already have one. And then also integrating climate-related risks and opportunities into the investment process, asking them to make sure that they are accounting for these long-term risks.
Before we move further, I want to go further into this agenda item. Could I have a motion? Is anybody interested in giving a motion to direct staff and Cambridge
to prepare a draft letter to all of our fund managers to follow the outline of the ESG policy that you've discussed and also appears on page 46?
Yeah, I would suggest the second and the fourth items as requests from ENGIE to its investment managers.
So that's a motion from Regent DiCarlo?
Yes, I would. I am happy to make that motion.
We have a second? It has to come from Las Vegas.
Second.
It can't be me. We have a second. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I just have one thing I have to say.
Yes.
I just think it's the right thing to do, and this is what our students are asking for. It's the way the world's going. It's the way the United States is going. I had the privilege of touring Tesla, and, you know, the days of Henry Ford's automobile are over, I think, and this is the way we're going in the future. It's the future. It's now and it's the future, and it makes sense.
Thank you. Regent Hayes.
Yeah, I have some questions and concerns. I guess the first is we're merely just
regarding the motion?
Regarding the motion, yes.
Okay.
What would it be
Go ahead.
Regarding? Okay.
It could have been anything in agenda item number five. I have no idea, Regent Hayes.
Well, we have a motion on the table, so that's the appropriate thing to discuss. We're talking about approving a motion that would require have a draft of a letter written that would encourage our managers to have an ESG statement. Is that the motion as I understand it?
Yes.
Okay. So we're merely just check a box. They have a statement. We don't care what's in it. Like, we're not saying that their ESG statement must contain certain things. They can merely have an ESG statement that says, we will look at the environmental, social, and governance policies of companies we invest in, period. And it could really mean nothing. So this could really be a hollow request of them on their side that they just merely have some statement that means nothing. So I'm not sure that this accomplishes anything. The second part is, I don't know how we determine. I mean, with environmental, great, let's put wind up and stop using coal, but then it kills the birds and the bats. Is that good for the environment or bad for the environment? How do we determine that? Social, there is a major battle going on across college campuses and boardrooms across this country about what is the proper way to treat social equity, diversity, et cetera. Are we going to vet those comments or their statements to see what their opinion is on that? What if they do something contrary to what we believe or what we think our institutions should? I think that looking at investing more responsibly and in businesses and hedge funds and others that support goals and principles that we and our institutions would want to support is a good thing in general. I just don't see how this motion gets us there because, one, someone could just say, yes, I have an ESG statement that says I will do ESG. All right, they check the box and they can go out and do anything they want. Or their views on the environment, social, and governments could be completely contrary to what we would believe, but they've written that they have one. I just think this is a little incomplete at this point for us to move forward and request something without any substance to it of our managers.
Thank you. My understanding was is that was a direction from Yale's CIO that I had referenced as the template. What would you recommend, knowing that this committee has directed our investments to be carbon neutral at the least? And what would you be? What would you recommend in terms of our letter from the system to all of our managers?
I see. So, I think I hear Regent Hayes's concerns, and to address that concern about having an ESG policy, I'll also mention that managers' approach to ESG is part of our assessment of any manager. If they have an ESG policy, part of our assessment of that manager is that ESG policy sensible in light of their strategy? We don't expect, we as Cambridge don't make a determination, and nor do our clients typically, about whether that manager's ESG policy reflects any individual investor's particular values, but rather that they are using ESG factors as financial indicators for long-term financial returns. These are not meant to be values-oriented judgments. And the Yale letter in particular asks their managers to consider climate-related risks. So it's this fourth one down. So my initial recommendation was simply to promote that more managers should be establishing ESG policies, which would just force them to articulate what that policy is. The system has delegated to Cambridge the manager selection, and then we delegate to managers the definition of their strategy. And we have to determine whether that strategy and that approach makes sense. And I don't think that having an ESG policy is inconsistent with any manager's strategy, but that ESG policy might look different for different managers and different strategies. And then it's up to you folks to evaluate whether we're doing our job. So I don't think we would be getting into the weeds and saying the ESG policy has to say X, Y, or Z about environmental or social issue X, Y, or Z.
Here's a suggestion. Why don't you just send a letter to Cambridge and say, make sure all your managers take climate change into account. And then it's incumbent on you to say, this is our policy. This is what we've requested for our managers. This is where we are today. And this is where we're going, because we've effectively delegated every other element of the manager selection to them. Then all you need to do is send one letter to Cambridge.
So that
one letter to Russell.
I'm sorry? I like where Russell's going with being more specific, climate change or something like that. I mean, I think about environmental. I mean, mining is a huge industry in our state, and some people would view mining as an environmental harm. And are we going to be using money that is generated by the public in Nevada to divest of one of our major industries? But if we focus on something more specific, whether it's climate or other things, I feel more comfort with that than just saying someone has a statement that could be opposite to our beliefs in Nevada.
Do you mind if I?
I'm sorry?
Mind if I make a comment?
Go ahead, Russell.
So it's Matt Gerson.
I mean, Matt.
Russell. So just to kind of echo a little bit of what Wendy said, I think most investment managers, actually all investment managers we're going to use, and I suspect Cambridge should use, they frame this purely from a profit motive, if you will, a financial window. And they say to themselves, if I incorporate an ESG factor, whatever that may be, does it allow me to buy companies that are likely to do better than the broad market over time, right? And that's in their best interest. They should be doing that already, because if there is some rule or kind of criteria that they could apply that would allow them to do better against the market, you got to believe they're going to be making that choice. So there is a bit of an alignment already. Like Cambridge, our research teams have a set of ESG criteria, and they say, does this manager have a policy statement? Do they look to invest on the basis of those criteria? And then I think the important question is, can we see that? When you ask the question, the stock you've picked, does that align with this philosophy that you have, but is really in the lens of a financial motive, right, to outperform the benchmark, but it's nicely kind of consistent with a broader, maybe philosophical goal. We may not get to my section, but there's a paper at the end that we've written. It's called Materiality Matters. Mm-hmm. And essentially it's, let's look at the criteria that you could apply and say, what is material in from a fiduciary perspective in outperforming the benchmark? And let's orient the portfolio towards that. To Regent Hayes' point, there is sometimes criteria that will create a negative consequence down the road, where if you strip out an entire sector just point blank, that's a little blunt, and it maybe accomplishes the goal, but there is perhaps return opportunity that's left on the table that you want to take advantage of for as long as it's reasonable to do so. So I guess I just want to throw that out there, is that I think you're going down the right path. I think Cambridge and Russell can accommodate what you're trying to accomplish and frame it really in the perspective that I think we come from, which is we're serving you as a fiduciary, not as a philosophy kind of argument where we have a view about something that is a softer judgment call. It really is.
Can I follow up on Regent Hayes' comment about accountability, too? I think if we properly put the accountability with these guys, then they can come back to us with a report and say, we asked all of our managers, because why do you want to get into the weeds with every individual manager? Say, give us a report once a year on what you've done on climate change specifically, and give us a summary report on the actions that you've taken and what the response has been from the underlying managers and how it's accomplishing our mission.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you're responsible for selecting the managers for every aspect of this, except for the investment policy, which is our purview. And so you report back to us and yeah. tell us how you've done.
Yeah.
And then we can say good enough or not good enough.
You know? And if I can also maybe build on that, suggestion, I was suggesting that Cambridge would do this on behalf draft. I mean, we would get it vetted by NG, but we would do all of the work, all of the outreach, all of the communication, because I think it's really powerful. It's powerful for an institution like NG to be making change in the investment management industry. Right. Cambridge, we already ask every one of our managers these questions. But it's more powerful if we can attach an institution, an asset owner's name to it and say, Nevada System of Higher Education is looking to its investment managers to have an ESG policy. We would like for you to report to us on right. that and measure that over time. Now, we're leery of having, say, a litmus test and saying, like, okay, well, we're going to drop this manager tomorrow. We want to look at things comprehensively and allow for time to engage the manager, and we would do that on NG's behalf. But I think there's a powerful signaling mechanism, both to the financial services asset management
industry.
But you
can decide if you want a litmus test. You can say,
you could.
But for now, 24% of the managers say they pay attention to climate issues. But you may say, you know what, that's not good enough. So we want you to take a second look at these managers, either go back to the managers you have or find new managers, because we want yeah. that to be 48%
yeah.
next year.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So the procedurally, I think what we would need to do going forward, listening to these discussions, I would make a recommendation that you amend the motions, that the staff would draft a letter in conjunction with the input from Cambridge and Russell, draft a letter from the system to our two OCIOs to direct their managers that are the managers comprised in those portfolios. And I think, Regent Hayes, to your point, I think what we should be doing at this stage in the game, especially in item number five, we're talking about climate change, and we were talking the issue that's been raised in terms of either carbon neutral or divestiture. It would be focused on climate change considerations and initiatives of those managers.
So not the ESG policy?
So I'd ask Chair Trachuk, we had an original motion made and then a second by Regent Perkins. In my understanding, are you intending to amend your original?
I'm asking for a friendly yeah. amendment.
Yes. I'm making the friendly amendment.
Okay.
To
your motion.
To enhance my motion by having Russell and Associates and or Russell Investments and Cambridge write the letter.
Work with staff.
Work with our staff to write the letter
right.
that they in turn will then send to all of our managers requesting what we asked for in the motion. Is that right?
I think if I could have the motion with the amendment restated, and then if there's a second to the amendment.
Okay, Rick.
Okay, the my suggestion on the motion, which I can't make.
Yes.
My suggestion would be that our staff direct in writing on behalf of the system our two OCIOs, Cambridge and Russell, to instruct their managers that is of high concern to the Nevada System of Higher Education that the climate-related risks and opportunities be taken into account in the investment process.
It's not my... I'm probably speaking out of turn here, but I also an accountability piece and to report and also working in conjunction with the staff to report back on the results of that on a regular basis or something along
annual
those lines.
Or something, yeah.
And which would require the annual reporting back from the managers to our two OCIOs who would then report back to us.
And so that's the motion.
Is that what you said?
As stated from, amended by Regent Del Carr.
Yeah, motion to our staff directed in writing through our OCIOs to instruct their managers because this is of high interest and concern to the Nevada System of Higher Education, that climate and ESG...
No, just climate.
Just climate, okay. Just climate be taken into consideration, and that we require a reporting back within a year to the committee.
Climate-related risks and opportunities.
To the committee.
And then I will agree with that change.
If there's a second to that.
Thank you, Regent Perkins.
Thank you.
I just have a quick question. Just a quick question.
Yes.
They're going to draft it, and at our next meeting, we will approve the statement that's sent out. Or the letter
What's the will of the committee on that? I would like to do this sooner rather than later. Our next meeting will be in 6 months, Regent Hayes.
I just feel more comfortable that a letter being sent on behalf of ENSHE, and one, we're just one committee, we're not even the full board, and it's a letter being sent on behalf of ENSHE, that at least this committee has a chance to vet the final product.
Okay, so how about this then? We have the draft letter be sent by Andrew to members of the committee. This then would have to be presented. I believe we were thinking about a special meeting in October, so it would come to the full board in October, and that at that point the full board would have the opportunity to approve or disapprove of both the item and the letter.
Great solution. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And
the letter is only going to two people.
Yes,
right.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And so then would it be all right? And this, I don't know that this needs to be in a letter. Could we use the system's name?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, great. Because I think that's powerful.
I said that in my motion.
Great, perfect.
And if this will go to the full board in October.
Yeah.
And then so you'll have the board's action.
Great.
Because this committee can't direct something on behalf of the full board.
So I call for the vote.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Passes unanimously. So to short circuit the rest of the discussion, I think that's an important first step.
Yeah.
You had a couple pilot programs that you're looking to us to approve. Is that correct?
To get guidance on, frankly, because I'm still looking for the system's priorities. Yeah.
Leading into that, my question would be, if, for instance, the system were to, the board were to make a determination that we should divest from fossil fuels tomorrow, what would be the impact on our investments, and what would be the impact to our institutions and our students?
I would say that that is unknowable. Because we can't predict the future. We don't know what these assets are going to return. So from a financial perspective, we just do not know. I don't think that that means that that's not the right question for approach for an institution to take. I work with a couple of clients that have made that decision. One was a Jesuit organization. Another one was a small liberal arts college with a massive environmental studies program. But they did... They created, and as did University of California, they've had a stakeholder engagement process where they really have tied it back to what is the mission and the values of this institution. And so we have a survey teed up to go to the campuses. And I think if we can build the case, we will be in an excellent position to then make some decisions about whether or not this unknowability of future returns is still the right choice for ENSHE.
In your opinion as the fiduciary, would that be a responsible position for the Board of Regents to take at this time?
I do think so. And I think the fact that there are institutions doing this, and I've worked with it, and I'm fully supportive of it, but it still is less than one half of 1% of higher education institutions in the United States. Right. So it's a very, very small minority. I think that it is a very reasonable position to take, but I think it requires some groundwork to really assess the fundamental You know, I think Regent Hayes mentioned a couple of potential concerns around what the implications would be, and are all stakeholders truly on board? And I think we can get to that answer in a couple of ways. Number one, what are UNLV and UNR foundations doing in this regard? Have those two campuses adopted any stance in this regard in those two pools, which my understanding is are much bigger than these pools? How are these reflected in the mission statements of each of the eight campuses? I found the mission statement of UNR online, and it really does cite environmental sustainability. So I think, and this survey that we've teed up would really start with just the campus officers, and I'd be very pleased to be put in touch if folks are comfortable with others, you know, on like sustainability committees at each campus to just understand what is the campus doing in this regard. So can the Board of Regents as fiduciaries really have conviction that you know, evidence and conviction that this sort of policy stance on the pool of assets really reflects the will of the underlying institutions.
Matt.
I would completely echo what Wendy said, and the reason being is that I think you want to be in good company when you make this choice. I think it's a long-term decision, and I think I would agree with her that I think the preponderance of evidence at this point suggests that removing carbon from your portfolio is probably going to be reasonable long-term. We're talking 20, 30, 40 years. However, it requires the system to kind of ignore what happens in the energy markets. And an example might be is that this year, you know, energy has been all over the place. We've had highs and lows in oil prices and the returns that would have come with that. If we were to, let's say, foresee a period where we came into global strife where there was a lot of pressure on oil prices upward, it means that if you divested now, that the portfolio wouldn't participate in that upward movement in oil or the energy companies that produce that. And you just have to say, I'm okay with that. That's an opportunity cost that I acknowledge, and I'm happy with that because I'm still fulfilling my long-term goal, which is to be out of that space because of things like the professor raised earlier, is it's, there's trapped capital or trapped assets that have a zero value long-term. And I'm saying I'm okay with it because let's call it the underperformance or the price impact of that is so great on those companies. I just don't want to hold them, even if they outperform in the near term.
And I have a visual for that on page 50, which really looks at the Vanguard. This is for the operating fund in particular. The current Vanguard benchmark versus the Vanguard ESG index, which is screened. It excludes fossil fuels and then a couple of other categories. And what you see here is that, you know, over a one-year period, the screened ESG index, you see the little arrows up above, it might outperform by 3 percentage points over a year. But back earlier in June 2016, it underperformed by more than 3 percentage points. So does this institution have conviction that when you see this kind of, it could be outperformance, but it might be underperformance over shorter periods. But does the institution really have solid conviction of, we still think this is the best, this is the best strategy for us because of who we are as an institution? Because if we do this, I want it to be durable. That's my biggest concern. I don't want us to take a stance and then when there's investment committee turnover in a year, 18 months, 2 years, the next group says, well, I don't agree with that position, and it seemed arbitrary, and we want to change our strategy. Because if we repeatedly change strategies in reaction to recent underperformance, you're going to be locking in losses and doing very poorly. So I'm all in, like my role at Cambridge Associates, I'm very deep in this ESG and climate space. I'm very supportive, but I want it to be done in a way that is durable. And will really benefit the institution.
Here's an analogy, too. About 30 years ago, the issue was tobacco. And everyone said, tobacco is a horrible thing. It kills people. We got to divest from Philip Morris. Well, Philip Morris turned out to be an excellent stock. It really did very, very well. But people consciously made the decision, I don't care, and I'm going to divest of tobacco no matter what. So actually it contributed to long-term underperformance, but people were okay with that.
Right.
This could be the same thing.
Right.
Maybe energy, like you say, oil goes through the roof, and we underperform as a consequence by a small percentage, because it's only going to be a small percentage of the portfolio.
Right.
But still, with 2020 hindsight, in 20 years, people may look back and say, you shouldn't have divested from oil.
Right.
Because it was the wrong, maybe it was the right thing from a long-term perspective, but it was the wrong thing from a 20-year perspective.
Right.
But, you know, based on preponderance of, you know, the evidence and your good judgment, you decide, I'm okay with that, just as people did with tobacco.
Might I make a suggestion? I realize on the agenda we have called for discussion of a pilot project, but it seems to me that a better way for us to go would be to start the survey now, and then we can get more data coming back to us either in our meeting 6 months from now. I think we're scheduled to be meeting in March. And that way there we would have, first of all, we would be giving a direction, and then we would be making decisions based on data.
And you've also taken a step already by asking the OCIOs to report back on how effective they've been thus far with climate change. So.
Yep.
So the motion would be just to direct Cambridge, and Wendy in particular, to put together with our staff a study at all of our institutions to take the climate, if I can use that twice,
take the temperature.
Take the temperature. That's even worse. What the will of the institutions would be to move in this direction of divestiture. Is this a policy concern and for each of the individual campuses that we as a board should be taking into consideration when we make our investments decisions? So the motion would be, assuming somebody's willing to make one, would be direct Cambridge to, and if Russell's interested.
Well, we've already actually collaborated on a survey that really looks at both the campus mission statements, their internal operations, approach to sustainability.
To direct the two OCIOs to put together a survey for all of our eight institutions. Do I have a motion?
I'll make the motion to have our two OCIO, collaborate with our NCHE staff to put out a survey to our eight institutions in support, or no, not in support, to
take the temperature.
The temperature of how they want to see this committee go forward in regards to diversifying from fossil fuels.
Mr. Chairman,
in our portfolio.
Can I clarify something on this? I just want to make sure that from who we're sending it to now. I know Wendy had mentioned that what she was envisioning is that the survey would go to campus officers. I just think it's important to clarify who it's going to.
Yes, the campus officers.
Okay.
We have a motion. We have a second.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion to second. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And seeing no opposition, passes unanimously. So I think that's a better way to go forward on agenda item number 5.
And can I make one final point on page 47? Just I wanted to highlight that in Cambridge, in CA managed assets, and in many ways this reflects my team's bias and my and EJ and some of our other colleagues in San Francisco, our bias towards ESG and climate aware strategies. Right now, CA managed assets is already more than 10% allocated to strategies that are really looking proactively at these factors in renewable energy, in other sort of sustainable real assets, or just very ESG aware, ESG forward approaches, where that is a key driver of their investment process. It's not just a tick the box. This is a manager where this is a major focus of their strategy. So we are already doing this too.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, we'll move now to agenda item number six. Okay. I'll start with you, Andrew.
We'd want to have Wendy maybe go through the performance first.
Sure. And we can be very brief here because the strategy and the investment policy for the operating fund for many years has been a very low-fee passive strategy. So performance basically has been coming in within about 10 basis points of the policy benchmark for a very long period of time. There's really no surprises here on page... it was actually a supplemental page that we added it had been page 12 of 40, but now we have an updated page with performance through 831.
That's 2 of 4 in the supplemental materials?
It was 12 of 40 for IMB6. But then there were new pages, so I guess I don't know how those new pages were numbered.
Mr. Chairman, I think it begins on page 3 of 4.
Okay.
The performance.
Okay. Oh, okay, great.
Yeah. On the supplemental.
Oh. I don't have a supplemental. Yeah. Okay. What you're doing.
You should.
So basically, no surprises here. Through August 31st, on a calendar year to date, the operating fund has returned 8.6. It's 10 basis points ahead of its policy benchmark. Trailing 1 year, 2.9, 10% behind its policy benchmark. And, you know, looking back over the long term, this has always been the policy has been to be very low fee, passively invested. So we just are performing in line with our benchmarks.
Okay.
Would you like me to address the costs question?
Please.
Sure. So that is on page 9 of 40, and the total fees on this pool for 2018 were $1.6 million. Remember, this is on a much, much larger base, so that equates to 20 basis points, one-fifth of 1% is the fee on a percentile basis.
At some point, we should rethink that, too, or reflect on, does it still need to be a pat? You know, the concern is we want to pay more out if we increase it to 2.75%.
Right.
So if you want to increase the return, maybe the recommendations would be for more active managers aggressive approach in terms of investment mm-hmm. we've had historically.
Yeah, we would be very supportive.
If you want to make more money, you got to take more risks.
So. That's right. That's right. And we had actually had that on page 7 of 40 as a recommendation for the next meeting is this is something that we've really been working on for a number of years, is really undertaking a comprehensive investment planning review of the operating fund. We did part of this by stripping out the short-term and long-term tranches. I'm sorry, short-term and intermediate-term tranches. And now we'd like to look at the long-term pool on a standalone basis, really understand the liquidity needs to understand whether or not the long-term pool could tolerate either illiquid assets, like private investments, like the legacy assets, or could it tolerate either illiquidity or more interim volatility and have a higher equity orientation and or active management. So those are sort of the three ways where we might add incremental return, but we'd need to really do deeper work with the campus business officers to make sure that of the time horizon for those funds in the long-term pool to make sure that they can tolerate illiquidity, volatility.
That would be the action, if you want us to direct us to do that piece of it as far as looking at alternative approaches to the long-term pool. I mean, that would be the only action on the side.
Vice Chancellor Klinger, what action would you like to see us to take on this action item?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think if you look at what Wendy has provided, and it's on page 8 of 40 in your packet, it's really the discussion about whether alternative assets may be appropriate for the long-term pool. On the next item, we have a recommendation there to move funds out of the short-term pool into the long-term pool, and really the next step is then to look at the asset allocation in the long-term pool. So the only action on this item that I would recommend is just giving us direction to do that and bringing that back to the next committee meeting in March.
Would you need action to do that?
Not necessarily. We'll do it either way.
Okay. I think that this was incorrectly marked for possible action. I think this was, as is the previous items, for information only. Agenda item number 7 is where we're asking for direction from this committee as a recommendation to the board to change the mix, moving $75 million from the short-term pool into the long-term pool. So,
and actually, sorry, I think on 6 there are then still an action item for recommendation, but I think it hinges on the $75 million coming in, because then we have recommendations of how to deploy that $75 million.
I think it's better for us to do it in agenda item number 7.
Perfect.
Okay. Any questions of anybody on the... agenda item number 6, yes?
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify for the record, it's actually agenda item number 9.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank okay. We move to agenda item number 7, handbook revision statement of investment objectives and policy for the endowment fund for possible action.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your packet, there is some changes to the investment policies. On the briefing paper, I've outlined what those changes are. There's some clerical changes in there, changing the vice chancellor title to chief financial officer to reflect what the title currently is. And then I've laid out each section where we've made some specific changes. The first is in subsection 4A, just clarifying that a temporary deviation from the asset allocation policy would not constitute a breach, and that the deviation be rectified in one day. Now, there has been a question on this of whether or not that is actually possible to rectify in one day, or whether that we would even know within one day. So I think that's an item that may need some discussion as we discuss this this policy. Section 4D changes the rebalancing, and basically in the event that the endowment pool receives a contribution in excess of 10% of the fund's total asset size, the current policy requires the fund manager to develop and implement a plan for the investment committee. That plan then has to come back to the investment committee. What has been recommended for change is simply giving the fund manager 6 months to bring the fund into compliance without actually bringing the implementation plan back to the committee for approval.
That's almost contrary to the previous one.
So right.
10% cash comes in, so immediately you've thrown off the asset allocation, so you're in breach of the asset allocation. You have one business day to fix it.
I'm happy to clarify the intent behind each.
Okay, yeah.
So D would be...
4D.
Yeah, 4D. The intent here is, and both of these were motivated by our compliance group, because they're the ones who are monitoring compliance, and they are a tough crowd, I'll tell you. So 4D, they asked to put in simply because this would be outside of our actions, right? That if the system itself added to the pool, we would have, and 6 months is probably longer than what we would typically need to take. I think we only had 3 months at the beginning of our OCIO contract. 6 months is kind of our standard to give us wiggle room. We would be fine with making it be shorter, but this is just to have a reasonable period of an orderly implementation plan for something that was outside of what we do. The 4A, the idea behind this is that our compliance group considers a redemption at the time that a manager exposure comes off, but we don't get the cash until the next day. So we can't redeploy it into a new manager until the cash settles.
Okay.
That's the point here, is that it's giving time for cash settlement. So we might be under our minimum threshold for some asset class if a manager has been redeemed, but we haven't gotten the cash back. That's purely the intent here, is to offer this mechanism for cash settlement purposes.
Russell, I still don't get it. I don't understand. One day, you'll know, I guess, because you monitor this daily, presumably. You're
Correct.
Going to know when the cash is going to come in. But you're going to fix it in one day? Because you've pre-planned.
This is a known. This would be a known. It would known. Be like if we have we plan to terminate a manager.
But the problem is this is also going to account when the markets move. So if the stock market goes up 5% in one day or 10% in one day and throws your asset allocation off, you're going to have to fix that the next day.
No, it means that for that case, we would be in violation and we would need to come back to ENSHI and report this violation. And we would have to say because of the market movements last month, we violated and we are coming back.
You don't want to know if they're out of, if the limit's 60%, that they went 60.1% for a day.
Our compliance group will require us to send you that notice.
Wow.
So what this allows us to do is...
Can we fine you if you do this? If we can make money off this, then it sounds like a good idea.
So your compliance group, if I understand this correctly, required you to include required you to suggest to us to include this language in 4A that the such temporary deviations shall not constitute a breach of the policy ranges investment guidelines provided that the exposure deviations are rectified within one business day?
Correct. Wow. Because we run into situations where we have a planned trade and they will refuse to approve the trade in advance because they say no, because you'll be out of compliance effectively overnight. And so what the alternative to adding this would be any time we run into that situation, which candidly is probably going to be rare, but it has come up, we would have to write to Andrew's office and say, please, could we have a waiver? Because our compliance group will require you to sign off to be out of compliance overnight between the time that this one manager is redeemed and we implement the cash into this other manager on the next day.
So what this, as I understand this, what this change does is it just says that the our OCIOs will not be out of compliance if this event happens and is corrected within a day.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. We don't. But I mean, that's not the system's problem. That's our OCIO's problem. They're the ones that have to fix it in a day.
Yeah, correct.
And they have to give us notice.
Correct.
Is there any reason why this would be? Russell, is there any reason why this would be detrimental to the system to require something this onerous on our OCIOs if this is what they're asking for?
I don't see any legal reason. I mean, like I say, you could sue them, because they breached the contract. It's creating an unrealistic expectation. But if you agree, if you say you're going to send a waiver every time that you have to exceed that one business day, then I guess that's okay. Now, I'm only concerned that the staff might get 30 waivers a year. Like, are they ever going to get a waiver?
If we don't put this in,
you won't need the waiver.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah. This is meant.
But if it's 2 days, you will need a waiver, right?
Right, but that's already the case. That's already the default.
Okay.
And not really a waiver. It's more notification. It's more us saying, like, look, markets plummeted last week. We're notifying you that we were out of compliance, and here's our plan to get back into compliance. That's already a standard procedure in the investment policy statement.
Okay. And then what's the interaction between the two? Like, if the 10% comes in and you have 6 months to do it, but that's throwing you off? Like, how are you going to reconcile the 6 month, if there's a cash flow contribution, you have 6 months to move that money around, but the 10% cash has already thrown off your asset allocation. Now you have 1 day to rectify. Like, how do you deal with the conflict between those two requirements?
I would say I would think this is only saying you're not in breach, and this is also saying you're not in breach, so you'd be doubly not in breach.
Okay.
Okay. It's not directing them to do that. It's saying that if this happens, this does. They're not in breach.
Okay.
This is giving them that exemption.
Okay. So Joey supersedes the other.
But the point is, your compliance people are requiring.
They really are because otherwise, and this happened to me for another client. We had to go to the client and say, we're going to be out of compliance overnight. So, Mr. Andrew Klinger, could you please waive and approve this transaction that and she's comfortable. Our compliance group has some onerous requirements of us too, but they're looking out for really upholding the spirit of this policy statement.
You okay with this, Joe?
I need
I need some more time to take a look at this. And one of my suggestions to the committee is, because we're discussing handbook revisions that ultimately need to go to the full board, even if the committee doesn't take specific action on it today, it can still be agendized and go to the full board for consideration to
go to the December or October.
A little bit more time to take a closer
sure.
look at this.
And we'd be happy to have conversations.
Yeah, that's fine.
And,
that's good.
We're yeah.
fine with that.
The does anybody on the committee have any problem with taking no action on agenda item number 7? We will then ask that it be put on the next full board agendas when we have more information, since both our council and our CFO are asking that we do take that position. Okay.
I think it's good.
Okay, we'll move now to...
Before you move on, though, I wanted to mention one other element was the benchmarks. We now have two benchmarks that are, if not in conflict, they're different. So we have a benchmark now that will say the return benchmark will be calculated based on 61.5% growth, 15% diversifiers, 11% real assets, and 12.5% fixed income and cash.
Oh, yeah. Where is this?
5B.
Okay.
And then the second benchmark says the benchmark will be 70% equity, 30% fixed. Just looking at the last 5 years, the first benchmark has actually underperformed the second benchmark. So I'm just asking, how are we going to reconcile these two things?
Well,
they're slightly different. They're based on...
These have always been in place since the beginning of this contract.
Doesn't mean it's a good thing. Okay. Maybe it's time to review.
Okay.
Like, why do we have two conflicting benchmarks?
They're
this
not...
This is one, this is number two. Well, not conflicting, but they're just differently calculated.
Correct, and I'm pointing you to the part up above, the policy benchmark, and again, this goes to the different, it's in 5A,
yeah,
and this is very inflation. Deliberate, is that these benchmarks have different time horizons. The policy benchmark is just based on market indices, and
right.
that's that calculation.
Right.
The simple benchmark is intended for a different reason, which is our policy correct? Could we do better with just a very simple 70-30
right.
benchmark? And that requires a longer time horizon, a full equity market cycle, to really evaluate whether that the policy was the right policy.
Yes.
So this is the approach that we had that we had proposed back at the end of 2016. It's our standard format for all of our OCIO contracts. So this is...
That's part of the policy now.
Mm-hmm. Correct. It's always been part of the policy.
Yeah. Okay. We'll move now then. We'll take no action on agenda item number 7. We'll move now to agenda item number 8, the bylaw reviews and standing committees of duties investment committee. Andrew.
Mr. Chairman, so these were, this is the result of a meeting actually in November of 2018. And so the wording changes there. Actually, first thing it does is it changes the order of the statements, moves 3 up to 2. And then adds the language that states INCHI concerning investments of the endowment and operating pools, and then strikes the and reinvestment transaction. So overall, pretty, I think, simple changes to the bylaws.
We have a motion for approval.
So moved.
We have a motion from Regent Hayes, second by Regent DiCarlo. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Passes unanimously. Move to agenda item number 9, annual review of investment pools. Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the result of a discussion I think the committee's been having for some time to look at the short-term pool and the cash flow needs of the system and make a determination as to whether or not we have the right size, if you will, between the short-term pool, intermediate pool, and the long-term pool. And so my assistant chief financial officer, who's actually in Vegas, Rhett Vertrees, did a cash flow analysis of the system going back in time to make a determination as to how much do we need to keep in the short-term pool to meet our operational needs on a day-to-day basis. And so, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to him. He has a presentation to go through for the committee.
Perfect.
Thank you, Andrew. Mr. Chairman, members of the board,
I'd like to go through this presentation, and it's basically an annual review of our investment pool. Board policy requires we do an annual review of our investment pools, and so I've prepared this presentation that will, I guess we'll use the PowerPoint to go through, really give you some history on whatever our short-term investment pool has been, so that making a decision on whether to allocate $75 million more into maybe the long-term pool, this may give you some history on why you might want to do that, okay? Might or might not. So your operating pool goals and objectives, you know, are set here. Oops. It talks about how you want to minimize your short-term pool to meet the system's daily cash needs and maximize the long-term pool to achieve higher investment returns or properly size intermediate-term pool. So what I'm going to show you here is what those pools have done over the last 3 years. This is your financial objectives for long-term pool, which is pretty certain. Reiteration of the discrete objectives of each of the different pools. So we have, as you can see from the Cambridge information, our pool is currently $850 million, our operating pool. It was $850. When I did this presentation, it was $768 million. So it fluctuates widely from short periods of time. But what we're going to see, let me get to that pool. So this was the operating pool back in February. Long-term pool is at $470 million. Your intermediate pool is at $92 million. And your short-term pool is at $205 million. $50 million of that short-term pool is set up as a reserve in case of market fluctuations. So our total was $768. As of Cambridge's report just in August here, I think that's changed from the long-term pool is still very similar, $468. Intermediate pool has went to $95 million. And our short-term pool has gone to $287.3 million. So total of $850 as of August. Here's a little history from Cambridge provided this information back in February, and I don't believe it's changed significantly. But you can see here these are basically your investment returns, and I'm going to focus on your annualized since inception. And I'm going to go through this very quickly because I know you guys we're running short here. So you can see that our long-term pool since inception has brought returns of approximately 6.5%, while intermediate pool term bonds, 4.1%. And our short-term bonds and cash, 2.3%. And I can tell you right now that our short-term bonds and cash, especially on the cash side, is below 2%. Our intermediate is running a little bit over 2%. But, you know, we're holding a lot of excess cash that is earning, you know, very low returns at this point. Just some of the performance highlights. Listen. So, I mean, one of the questions is does our short-term pool meet our system's daily cash needs? And has the intermediate-term pool provided a second line of defense? Now, those are part of your actual goals and objectives of these pools. So let's go to the next. So here's a cash flow. And it looks pretty wild there because I'm showing you all the different pools and how much they vary. But the main pool, the short-term pool as a whole is this gray area. And I can tell you that over the last 3 years has averaged about $212 million in that short-term pool. Okay?
With the $50 million reserve, correct?
With the $50 million reserve, that's correct.
Yeah.
So it's averaged about $212 million. And you can see here that if you look at, and I don't have a pointer here, but we have a couple of different investments. So our intermediate term is this orange section here. You can see that it has really generated very little returns over the last 3 years, and we've only drawn from it one time back in 2016. So it's pretty much, you know, making very little. It's making, you know, 2% or so on its money. And we also have another account. So our short-term pool, we have three accounts that we put our money into for the short-term pool. And that's the State Street account, the J.P. Morgan, and the Wells Fargo. Now, the Wells Fargo and the J.P. Morgan, which are in yellow and green, are the ones we use daily to fulfill our liquidity needs on a daily basis. And that's why they fluctuate wildly like that. You can see that the State Street which is the blue line that goes straight across, is another pool that we can pull from if we need to use it on a daily basis for liquidity needs. However, it's remained flat for the last 3 years. So I guess the question is, so when we look at that, I mean, the conclusions are is that, in my opinion, is that the short-term pool has comfortably covered our cash needs over the last 2 years. And you can see 3 years ago, it was only $19 million was pulled out of there to be utilized. So the other thing I'd like to point out is that the largest single day draw from these accounts was $79.3 million. So we are maintaining an average of $212 million in this pool. And not at any one time have we had to draw more than $79.3 to meet our daily liquidity needs. So, you know, there's a large difference there that could certainly be utilized to invest into long-term investments and generate higher returns. So, you know, these are the opportunities and some of the problems. So,
my question is, looking at the our intermediate term and our short term, are we right sized in both of those accounts? You're proposing that we take $75 million from the short term account and put it in a long term account so that we can increase our returns, but should we also be focused on the intermediate account?
Yes. So actually, I think the in the briefing paper itself for this item, we talk. I think the opportunity here is to either move it from the intermediate or the short-term pool, not necessarily just the short-term pool. So it just depends. You know, our intermediate term pool obviously generates a little bit more and than our bank accounts, basically, that hold the other funds in our short-term pool. So, however, when you look at what we were provided today by Cambridge and Russell Investments, you know, their bonds are generating significantly more money than these Wells cap funds that we have for the intermediate term pool as well. So it's just a question of, are we willing to shift some of that money and put it into? And I'm not here to suggest how you invest that. I'm just giving you information on, is there an option to take more money and maybe generate more returns? Go ahead,
Mr. Chairman. Maybe just to jump in here, if I may.
Yes, please.
So, and just I want to point out for the committee members when you're looking at this graph. I think the important takeaway here is to, if you look at the gray area of the graph, and that represents all of the assets in the short-term pool. And what you see on this graph here, based on the analysis that Rhett has done, is that that short-term cash pool has never dropped below $100 million, which is why we're making that recommendation to move that $75 million out of the short-term pool and put it into the long-term pool, because really the goal here is to obviously maximize the returns and then maximize the distributions to the institutions. And what Rhett was showing on some of those previous slides is that there's some big differences between your returns on the long-term pool, intermediate pool, and the short-term pool.
Well, the biggest gain would be if we took it out of the short-term pool, which has an annualized since inception return of 2.3%, and the intermediate-term bonds is 4.1%. So we get more bang for our buck if we took it out of the short-term.
Sure. Yeah.
I know I'm the investment guy, but this is my question about the liabilities looking forward. Is there any reason to believe that the future cash draws may be larger than $80 million? The answer is probably no, but just as a check.
Yeah, the answer is I would agree is probably no. And what I would point out about it's actually in Cambridge's item on the previous topic. But part of the next step is to do a look at the intermediate needs, the sort of the longer term 3 to 5 year window. This analysis that was put together here was fairly straightforward to do because we can go into the accounts, we can look at the balances, and we can see where they've been historically. To get an idea of where the campuses are going to go in 3 to 5 years really is going to take more time because we have to sit down with them, we have to understand their upcoming capital needs, the money that they've set aside for those capital needs, and that sort of thing. So I think that would be sort of the next step of this. But an interesting point that I would point out here is that even over the last 3 years where institutions, where they've made large withdrawals, for example, to cash fund a portion of a capital improvement, that has all come out of that short-term pool. As Rhett said, we've only touched that intermediate pool one time. So we have used that short-term pool, I would argue, to fund not only day-to-day needs, but those big outlays that you might see on an intermediate plan.
Right. So your recommendation is to move $75 million from the short-term to the long-term?
Yes.
Yes, Regent DiCarlo.
Yes, I make a motion to...
reallocate
up to $75 million from the short term and intermediate term pools into the long term pool.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might clarify, and I might need Joe's help on this. So under the packet under item 6, Cambridge has recommended the allocation of that $75 million to the various funds, and I just want to make sure we can do that under this item. The direction would be to move the $75 million, and then I guess the second part of that would be to allocate it based on the recommendations from Cambridge and Associates.
I think we could do that anyway. We just direct staff to reallocate up to $75 million. From the short and or intermediate pools to the long-term pool.
That's correct, Mr.
Okay.
Okay, do we have a second? Has to come from Las Vegas.
I'll second that.
Oh, thanks a million. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, first I'd like to commend staff and our OCIOs for looking and finding some underutilized assets and recommending ways to get more out of them. But if I'm reading this right, it seems like the intermediate term and the short term have a lot of unused assets. And I'm wondering, is $75 million enough? I mean, it seems like there's substantially, maybe even double that amount that has never been tapped into. And should we look at either eliminating or taking the intermediate one down to, I mean, it's only been used once in the last 3 years. I mean, do we knock it down to about $10 million total and reallocate that to the long term, as well as taking the $75 million out of the short term? Because what was the total number of the intermediate? Has $92 million in it that has basically been unused in 2 years, was used 3 years ago, and the short term, we just said it has $75 million at least that it can be taken out of. So if we kept $10 million in the intermediate term and took that extra $82 million out that we see here, as well as the $75 million out, I mean, that's going to allow these resources to perform better for us. My one concern, and I'd like to ask for our OCIOs and for Russell's thoughts on this, is we've heard a lot in the last year and a half or so about a potential recession. Are we actually, after having said all that, are we actually better off leaving it where it's at, because these are invested in funds that aren't going to lose money, and if we put these all into the long term, there's a lot more risk and exposure there when we keep hearing a recession is coming. So I guess I have two questions. One, if we're going to reallocate, should we almost eliminate or take down to next to nothing, maybe $10 million, the intermediate, as well as the $75 million, so put even more into long term? But if we're going into long term, is now the wrong time to be doing that?
I'll pose the second question first to Russell and then to Matt and to Wendy.
Market timing's a fool's game. I think the OCI, I think I'm speaking on behalf of the OCIOs as well. Who knows? The market may go down. They guess that it may go up. Who knows? But the point is, it's for the long term. It's going into the long term pool. You're not making a short term investment decision here. You may be wrong for a week, a month, a year. It's a long term pool. That's the whole point. So the idea is to take risk, and the opportunity set is to earn higher return.
Is there anything either one of you would like to add to that?
The only thing, and I think it's been answered, and I guess it was, as I heard the presentation being made, the about $80 million max draw that happened at one point, I think the question was raised, could it be larger? And I guess I just would ask, if you guys were real convinced that that isn't going to be larger than that, I think you're pretty in the clear to kind of redeploy this. But, you know, to the point about being conservative when we're coming into a period of maybe market turmoil, I don't know. I'm not trying to speak out of my mouth, but as long as that $80 million is like that is what the institutions are ever going to pull out of this pool, then I think you're fine.
In my comment on this, I appreciate what you're saying, Regent Hayes, and that's why I raised the question when we were talking about the intermediate pool. But I think it would be prudent for us as a committee to recommend to the board that we do this in tranches. Mm-hmm. Let's do the $75 million now from the short term to the long term. We'll meet again in March. We'll have a sense of where we are both within the domestic and the world economy, and staff can continue to work together with Matt and Wendy to see if we should be looking at something in addition to that.
I would note, Mr. Chair, that the agenda item today is specific and caps the committee's action at $75 million, too.
Okay. Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, maybe just to add and provide some clarification to Regent Hayes' question. Regent Hayes, I think your question is something that we've looked at, but it goes back to we need to do more work, I think, to make sure, and this goes to the question of, you know, what's going to be the maximum draw. And because we still have that intermediate pool there, which frankly is very liquid, and getting access to it is easy to do, it gives me some comfort having that there still until we do the longer term analysis about what are the 3 to 5 year capital needs of the institutions and are we going to draw more. And frankly, the policy that the board adopted in 2017 about spending down those capital funds, and I know the institutions have been putting together plans, and so I would anticipate potentially that we would be drawing down more funds in the future. I just don't, because we haven't worked with the campuses yet to have a good understanding of what that is, I don't know what that looks like yet. And so I think it would be prudent to hold off. But to your point, that is definitely something we're looking at for the future.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay, passes unanimously. Before we leave this item, do we have any business officers from any of the institutions here?
Yes. Mr. Chair, if I can just bring a point. There's some of us that have to be across the street at 1 o'clock for a UNLV Presidential Search Committee meeting, and we're at 12:30 now, and we may want to even have something to drink before we get over there. So just as a point of information. Eating might help, too.
Okay. So we'll go to agenda item number 10, extension of banking services contracts. Andrew.
Mr. Chairman, we don't have, and I don't know if Rhett has something to add on this. I think he may have some updated information. This was an item that came before the committee in June of 2018, given that our banking contracts were set to expire, and per policy, those contracts cannot be longer than 7 years. And so in June of 2018, the board approved a waiver to extend those. We're asking the board to approve a waiver again, but I will tell you that we are in the process of developing an RFP, and I believe, and I'll ask maybe Rhett Vertrees to give us the timeline on where we're at with those RFPs, because I believe the Bank of America one will be going out here shortly.
Yes, that's correct. It's going to be advertised Monday, actually, so 9:30, and we hope to have that completed by the end of the year. So, you know, this extension may not even impact that particular RFP. However, we have three other services that we also need to do RFPs for. And as you know, I came on relatively recently. So getting those all done in this short time frame is really not practical for us. And so we're just asking for this extension. And we're going to obviously keep that as short a time frame as possible. And we've actually have dates that we're looking to do these different RFPs. So JP Morgan Chase, which basically handles our P-card activity, our target date for that is in February of 20. TouchNet, which is really just a gateway service for our credit cards services with Wells Fargo, we're going to target both of those for the same time, and we're going to target those to be done in May of 20 as well. So, however, we need an extension because at this time we won't meet this December 31st deadline with these three other services, and may not meet it with Bank of America, but that one will be done shortly thereafter.
Thank you, Red. Do I have a motion to make this extension?
So moved.
Mr.
Regent Hayes, second. Regent Perkins, any discussion?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yes.
So how long are we extending this for? Is there a time limit that we're placing on this motion? Is it for like a year extension?
One more year, okay. Yes.
Yeah. For 1 year.
Thank you.
On 1 year or less as needed.
Yeah. Any other questions? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Passes unanimously. We go to agenda item number 11, new business. Is there any new business?
I asked, forgive me, I need to go back a couple topics. We had asked for a benchmark change on our diversifiers portfolio, and I think we didn't cover it.
That's part of the investment policy that's going to be discussed.
Oh, right. My apologies. Yeah. I missed that already.
Okay, seeing none, go to agenda item number 12. Is there any public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing
no
none,
comment.
Is there any public comment in Nalco?
No public
seeing
comment in Nalco.
Is there any public comment in Reno? Seeing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thanks for your indulgence.